So you've found the perfect spot to roll out the blanket. Your wicker basket is brimming with snacks. The bottle and glasses were packed first, let's be honest. You've even remembered the cutlery. Yes, it's a picnic. Spring has always been the time for picnics. And this year, especially for people in lockdown areas, they've become even more important. And while we're exploring that today, tell me about your favourite food to pack for a picnic. The more specific, the better, because I'm taking notes. It could be something that's really portable, something perhaps you only make for picnics, or it's a childhood favourite. Here to guide us through the topic of picnics is Adele Wessel. Adele is Associate Professor and Food Historian at Southern Cross University. And Adele, hello. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hi. Thanks very much, Michael.
Adele, if spring 2021 has a mascot for freedom, surely it is the picnic rug. But Adele, have picnics always played a big role in our outdoor lives?
I mean, it's interesting because the history of the word hasn't really been settled, and most people would probably assume that the English imported picnics to Australia, but they didn't always refer to outdoor eating. So the kind of common reference point is that it was a food that was shared. But like so much food history, there's also a suggestion that the French brought picnics to the English and then eventually to Australia. And I guess one of the things that I think it's important to acknowledge is that not everything associated with food history in Australia was also imported. So, of course, right. First Nations people before colonisation also shared food and ate together and also ate outside. So I think that
that's an important point. Just on that, Adele, while you're talking about First Nations people, I imagine because various nations, First Nations peoples would gather to trade and, you know, exchange knowledge and a whole bunch of other things, that these were oftentimes of, you know, perhaps celebration. And is that something that we need to acknowledge as part of a picnic's DNA, that there's a coming together and celebration through food?
Yeah, I think that that's right, Michael. So if you're thinking about Aboriginal people, people travelled seasonally to things like bunya festivals and so on, or to share oysters when that was in season. But in Australia as well, there's a long history of trade picnic days that were, you know, written into awards and so on. So barbers and timber workers and tobacconists would get together with their families, and it was a public holiday and a day off for workers. And that's not even exclusive to sort of Anglo-Australians either. So there are reports of Chinese Australians that celebrated up to 3,000 people got together at Clontarf in Sydney.
Wow.
Yeah, to celebrate the founding of the new republic in 1912. So there's a very long history in Australia, and I think that's one of the interesting things about picnics, that there is no kind of exclusive claim necessarily to them, and they can be really elite and indulgent, but they can also be very simple and informal and open to everyday people.
Well, that's interesting you say that too as well, Adele, because I imagine that in the early colonisation of Australia and thenceforward, that some of the DNA of the elitism that might have been imported into picnics from Europe would have been there, but then came the great democratisation of picnics, and you mentioned unions there and also cultural practices as well. So when did that, you know, picnics for everyone start to find its way into Australian life?
Well, it really begins to change around the end of the 19th century, and partly that's also to do with transport making it possible. So things like trains, picnic trains that were made available to people, and also having them instituted as public holidays made them available as well. But if we think about those very early events that were described as picnics, there was definitely a kind of very middle class aspect to it too. So Sunday school picnics, for example, that are documented from 1821, the kinds of food that people were recorded as eating were things like plum pudding and goose and so on. So it was kind of quite grand. And that's
how
sort
on
of,
earth
really
do you transport a goose and a plum pudding into a picnic? That's logistically quite difficult, I would have thought.
Yes, and they weren't necessarily travelling very far. So I think that those issues around technology and transport make a really big difference as well. So as cars became more readily available and Eskies as well. So, I mean, they were originally called car fridges. So that made it possible for people to be able to travel themselves and go on picnics as well. So that kind of definitely makes a bit of a change. But there's this, another sort of middle class element to this as well. So at the end of the 18th century, there was a movement around the establishment of parks and things like the Royal National Park and Centennial Park and so on. And the idea of kind of that urban people and people who were working class needed to have the healthy aspect of being able to be outside. So it sort of began as a sort of middle-class romantic sensibility, but then it also becomes something that's about rejuvenating the working classes and allowing them to be able to work hard for the rest of the week.
How fascinating. So it became a symbol of public health that you would encourage people of all classes to go outdoors and eat together.
Yeah, that's right, which is kind of interesting when you connect it with the changes with COVID restrictions as well and the idea of picnic days. There's that sort of continuing sort of health aspect to it as well because, of, you know, it's been seen as being less risky.
Yes, indeed. And on in a wider sense too, I mean, when you think about this historical relevance of picnics to our lives, when did picnicking start to be associated, for example, with horse racing?
Oh, well, that's interesting because picnics sort of preceded, well, horse racing has a very old tradition, but in Australia, the idea of picnics sort of preceded races, but people would take picnics to the races with them. So picnics and races are also happening around the same season. So it's something that happens in September.
Right.
In the Northern Territory, they instituted a picnic day holiday in the late 18th century where people who were working could also go to the races. And there are other kinds of aspects of sport that are associated with picnics as well. So a lot of the early photographs will show cricket stumps, for example, or people doing egg and spoon races. And
sack races?
Three-legged, that's right, three-legged races. So I think one of the interesting things about it that has perhaps changed, especially if we think about only picnicking with five people, is that one of the reasons that picnics were also popular is that you were able to meet in large groups. Mm. So whole school picnics, Sunday school picnics, trade union picnics and so on would bring lots of people together.
And I think it's important. Oh, by the way, if you just joined this conversation with me is Adele Wessel, Associate Professor and Food Historian at Southern Cross University. And we're talking here about the history and significance of picnics from the past right through to now, particularly in this, hopefully post-lockdown world. And I'd like to hear from you as well. What is your favourite food to pack for a picnic? Maybe it reflects a family history or a cultural history that's come through your family. It might even be something from your childhood. Adele, if we can talk to about, again, some of the aspects of food, cuisine, that might have been particularly at picnics and nowhere else. I understand in Australia there was a history of what's called the chop picnic. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's quite peculiar to South Australia, at least the term chop picnic. And they really flourished between the sort of 1920s and the 1960s when barbecues became much more common. So the idea of a chop picnic was that you would carry a cooking rack, and that could be something that was sort of just handmade or put together to place over the top of an open fire. And people would cook things like chops and sausages and onions and so on, and things like hogget and meat that came from sheep. So that's a really.
I don't think I've heard the term hogget for about 12 years, I reckon, Adele. Thank you for bringing that back into my lexicon. That's brilliant. So and so these kinds of meat, and this is would have been the precursor to a barbecue, which was far more formalised, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's some dispute about whether you would call a barbecue a picnic, because one of the things that did characterise picnics generally is that most of the food was cold and it wasn't cooked, except for the tea, of course, that you would carry and make hot.
In your thermos, yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the food initially would have been, porta-potty food, And remembering that people didn't have a way of keeping their food cool, so sandwiches could be wrapped in cold cloth as a way of keeping them cool. And people would, because you didn't have a means of carrying a lot of heavy equipment and so on as well, people would take things like syrup, lemon syrups or ginger syrups, and then add the water to them so that they didn't have to take large amounts of kind of liquid with them when they were travelling.
And yet, as you mentioned, in a chop picnic, there's a bit of paraphernalia involved by the sound of it. Because I imagine, in my mind at least, that in those days of the chop picnic between the 20s and the 50s or up to the 60s, that, you know, you had one of those portable, foldable grill handle things where you could actually, you know, compress the meat between these two racks that you'd hold together with your hands and then hold it over the fire. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, partly, but it could also just be an open rack that you would just put it on. But yeah, you would have to have a means of transporting it as well. And I think it's really interesting that it is something that's quite particular to South Australia. So when I mentioned it to other people, nobody else knew of them except for South Australians, and I kind of assumed that it was something that, you know, everybody did. But you know, listeners, if they're really interested, the state libraries have some fantastic photographs and collections, and the Western Australian Library has a lot of reminiscences of people about their picnics as well. So I'd be interested to know if there are other sort of traditions that were particular to a state.
Yeah, that'd be obviously that's great for your research. I can see why you wanted to put that up there on the radio, because that sounds like self-interest to me, Adele. but when it comes to this year and last year particularly, but let's talk about this year. Isn't it interesting that we now associate, certainly in some states and territories, this year's picnic ability as a sign of freedom? And from what you've been saying, in earlier times when there were union picnics and it was written into industrial awards, it would have been a different kind of freedom. And now it's all to do with the sense that we are able to reconnect as a population.
Yeah, I think I think it's interesting. I mean, I imagine those trade picnics as well as also being less about work or the separation of work from your social life, that you could bring your family with you to meet with your, you know, your colleagues and the people that you actually worked with. I think we probably use them less. I mean, there was an attempt in the 2000s to remove these from industrial awards, and quite a big stink about it at the time. But, you know, and they are sort of largely disappearing, but the Northern Territory still has its picnic day public holiday. It's an interesting thing, you know, in terms of the more recent elevation of picnics, and there's such a surge of interest in, you know, the ultimate picnic and so on. But a lot of people might not see a picnic as an idea of fun either. It's you know, I think that you know, that's something that people need to grapple with. Paul Daly wrote an article in The Guardian about this, and he was saying, you know, if I stand with a beer with a mate in a park, is that a picnic? Is that allowed? Or do I have to have a wicker basket and a lot of food?
And I think it's important to point out historically too that when it comes to some of those work-related or industrially related picnics, you know, all the timber workers and all the butchers might be there enjoying the fruits of what was often their wife's labour, not necessarily theirs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is, especially before barbecues, where a lot of men do actually tend to gather around and cook, women were doing a lot of the cooking, and so there is a tradition of kind of using picnics as well in feminist collectives. So that long association between women and cooking and food has meant that picnics could be used also as a platform for people to get together and organise around women's rights.
So it was, in some ways, in some instances, a great democratizer. It has been a fascinating conversation, Adele. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome, Michael.
Adele Wessel is an associate professor and food historian at Southern Cross University. We've been talking about the checkered history of picnics in this country, particularly given their significance right now for so many of us.